Today on Please Explain is part of our series within a series called Please Explain How to Save the World. We're going to talk about feeding the world. Millions of people around the world, this city included, and probably some living in this neighborhood, do not have enough to eat. And millions are actually starving to death. Joining us now are Dr. Glenn Denning, the director of the Center on Globalization and Sustainable Development at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's also a professor of professional practice in international and public affairs and the director MPA in development practice, the development practice program at Columbia. And J. Matthew Roney, who's a research associate at the Earth Policy Institute. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Hello.
We also invite calls and comments from our listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Glenn, I read that a global food crisis is coming, and I've also read that we're in the midst of a crisis right now. So what's meant by this phrase? Is there a clear definition used by scientists and economists?
Well, I'm not sure if there's a clear definition, but I think the statistics pretty much speak for themselves. When you have basically a billion people going hungry, not having enough calories to get by the day, if one in seven basically on the planet not having enough to eat, if you've got 170 million children stunted and basically their future lives, productivity is in jeopardy as a result of that, when you've got 8 million children dying each year from malnutrition-related causes, then all of that adds up to a global food crisis. Yes, it's scattered all over the place, but in fact, it affects everybody, for a number of reasons.
Now, is this anything new? Haven't people always gone hungry throughout the history of humans?
It's not new. In fact, the concern about it has been with us for a long time. In fact, we can go back to Thomas Malthus in 1798, basically predicting what he called enormous famines that would stalk the earth. And the basic idea was back then that he was putting forward was this planet at some point would meet the limits of its carrying capacity for the population. So that's been around for over 200 years, fears that Earth could not feed its population. It basically resurged in the 60s when India and China and Bangladesh and these places were suffering severe food shortages. But somehow, up until now, for a number of reasons, which I'd happily elaborate on, we've been able to actually keep food supply ahead of population. But every now and then, the balance tips in certain parts of the planet, and that leads to these acute food shortages. But at the same time, when we look across the whole planet, the fact that one in seven is not getting enough food is a matter of great concern. But so far, we've managed to keep ahead of the kinds of famines that Malthus was talking about.
And Matt, in this country and other Western countries, most of us have far more food than we need. But I wonder how many people are thought to be going hungry in the United States.
That's a great question. Actually, I'm much more attuned to the statistics that Dr. Denning just pointed out. But we know that poverty is a major concern in the United States. Actually, a report just came out that poverty rates have been going up recently, and so we know that food access is a big problem. But you're right; we have more than enough food to feed everyone, especially in Western countries like the United States, where we waste about 34 million tons of food per year. That's a statistic from the EPA. That amounts to about 14% of our municipal solid waste stream. So we know that that there's enough food for all. It's just a matter of getting it to where it's needed.
Is the problem worse in urban areas or in rural areas?
Well, there tends to be a lack of access to healthy food in urban areas. I know that. Where grocery stores are few and far between, and the cheapest food tends to be the least healthy. So that is a major concern. And in rural areas, they may not have access to that food either.
It sounds to me, Glenn, like this is really a distribution problem, at least in our country. Is distribution a problem everywhere?
Well, I think we often talk of the three components of food security, and that availability, the actual food being existing to be able to feed a population. Secondly, access. Now, do the people who need the food, do they have the capacity to actually purchase the food or work for the food? And the third part is utilization, which is even if they have the food, if other things such as lack of clean drinking water and the like, poor health conditions, they don't actually get to utilize the food that they may have. So all three of these are important factors in the developing world. In some cases, it's very much a question of production. And I think it's good to sort of disaggregate the problem into the major regions of the world where hunger and malnutrition are the major problems. And the two big ones that stand out are South Asia, essentially India, mainly India and Bangladesh, and sub-Saharan Africa. And, what we see there are somewhat two different explanations. In sub-Saharan Africa, agriculture has not actually kept pace with population, and we have a situation where almost 30% of the population there are short of food. It's not quite the same explanation in India, where India exports food. It's a distributional factor there, and we still have, despite the economic growth of India, despite a green revolution in India, we have 42% of the population, or 42% of children are stunted. So there it's much more of an access issue. So the poor do not have access to the quantities and the quality of food they need.
Jerry from North Babylon, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I'd just like to know how the World Food, is there such a thing as a World Food Organization? And how would they distribute food into needed areas? Like I know that in Somalia, where we tried to distribute food, like the military went in, and that situation with what they call about the movie Black Hawk Down, where the soldiers were attacked and the food was taken by the warlords and not distributed among the people. Is there an organization that can distribute that food without that problem?
Well, there. If I can jump in here,
sure.
Leonard, the World Food Program of the United Nations does work to serve millions of people every year in countries where there are emergency food situations developing. But the caller is right that there are problems in getting the food to where it's needed because of political strife or upheaval.
And that continues in Somalia now with the Al-Shabaab insurrection.
The Al-Qaeda-affiliated militant group that banned outside agencies from delivering food aid in Somalia, and especially in Mogadishu. And in the 2007-08 food price spike, global food crisis, we had World Food Program grain trucks being hijacked in Sudan before it could get to the Darfur camps. And so there definitely is a big problem sometimes in getting the food to where it's needed, even if the effort is there.
Listener John left a comment on our show page. He said, much of the produce I eat in winter comes from Mexico and South America. Can this export be linked to any starvation there or in other places?
Well, let me jump in. I think
you don't have to apologize for answering, either of you.
I think
that's
the
idea.
I think quite the contrary, and I actually, as you can get from my accent, I'm not American. I work here, but it's an interesting political debate at the moment. This whole issue of buying locally, buying American versus buying from other parts of the world, and I think what's very important is that much of the imported food that we see, whether it's mangoes from Haiti, rice from Thailand, or raspberries from Central America. I mean, much of this is actually grown by small-scale farmers, really living on the edge of poverty. And I think it's actually a good thing if the wealthier countries can open their markets to supplies, particularly of commodities that are really much better grown in the tropics and those parts of the world as opposed to being grown here. So, I think it's not a disadvantage, it's actually an advantage for our consumers here in the United States and in Europe and so on to purchase products, from, especially when they're coming from small-scale farms in the developing world.
I'm assuming that you're from Australia?
Correct.
Where there aren't that many small-scale farms, but Australia benefited from being part of the British Commonwealth. The Commonwealth countries sent a lot of food to the UK, didn't they?
That's a good point. I mean, that's true. Australia is a very, agriculturally, a very productive country, very much like the United States. It's a major exporter. It's a major player on the world market. So it's an important contributor to food aid, as your earlier caller indicated. Going back to that, I'd like to make one important point, which many people miss. We see on television the Somalias, the Horn of Africa, and so on. We see these disasters, and we see the great work of NGOs, the World Food Program, and others. But that's actually a very small part of the global food problem. That constitutes maybe 7 or 8% of the hungry people in the world in these very acute emergency situations. 92% of the hungry are basically sitting there. They're working on farms. They're living in urban areas. They're not subject to, you know, the CNN cameras and the like. They don't get enough to eat. They don't get enough calories, and they don't get the quality they need. And we need to focus a lot of attention on them as well, even though they don't grab the headlines in the evening news.
My guests on today's Please Explain series within a series, Please Explain How to Save the World. In this case, we're looking at Feeding the World and Global Hunger. Dr. Glenn Denning, the of Columbia University, and J. Matthew Roney of the Earth Policy Institute. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So let's follow up on what you're saying there. You're saying that in places where there is plenty, there are still a lot of people who are going hungry. How do we explain that? Is it just simply a matter of economics? People not having enough money to feed themselves?
Yeah. I mean, it's economics. It's a combination of things. And again, as we look in different parts of the world, in Africa, for example, farms there are not using the potential that they have. And there are many complicated reasons, which we won't go into, for that. But basically, the African continent could be a lot more productive than it currently is. And the good news is we basically know what needs to be done in terms of the science, in terms of the policies, in terms of the institutions. And we're now starting to see, I think, some real progress there. I personally predict that 10, 20, 30 years from now, we're going to see Africa as a net food exporting part of the world. So I think that's one very positive message to come out of all these things. A lot of improvements are taking place on the continent. But again, we tend to focus on Somalia and Zimbabwe and so on, but a lot of positives are coming out of Africa. I think India is a different story in terms of the challenges. There's a lot of inequality, inequity within India. There are a lot of people who don't have land, a lot of people who don't have jobs, and they're the ones who are in this category that are not getting enough to eat. And that's very much a government policy thing. I think India has the potential to solve that problem. Brazil did an amazing job. President Lula, over a period, let's say the last 10 years, he drastically cut hunger and malnutrition in his country through very clear policies and strong political leadership. And you know, we've got a few examples of that around the world, which I think can you know, set the tone for what can be done in some of these more difficult areas.
But Matt, wasn't there a green revolution 20 or 30 years ago that was supposed to eliminate the kinds of problems we're seeing on those small farms in Africa?
Well, there was a green revolution in India back in the beginning of the 60s, which did allow for much improved production and to lessen the potential for widespread famine. In Africa, there hasn't been that kind of green revolution, largely because of the lack of investment that Dr. Denning has been talking about.
Is this a legacy of the colonial years?
I think it's partly that, but even after the decolonialization, agriculture has been very severely underfunded. along with public health and nutrition.
By the governments involved? Don't Western countries come in with aid programs?
There are aid programs, but more often than not, it's not enough, and the spending may not be targeted where it's needed in order to overcome some of the institutional barriers as well.
So all the NGOs who are going there perhaps are not really doing the kinds of jobs they should be doing, or is it that they're also fighting against traditions?
Well, some of the discussion right now, there's an impending food shortage because of major drought, widespread drought in the Sahel region of Africa that includes Chad and Mauritania. It's sort of above the Sahara, below North Africa. And organizations such as the World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations are talking about emergency aid right now, but also looking further into the future, looking at what needs to be done to improve the capacity of smallholders in those countries to produce food over the long term, to have actual food security rather than needing this sort of reactionary food aid establishment. I'm not diminishing the efforts of the World Food Program. I think it's very laudable what they've been able to do around the world, but it does seem to be more reactionary. There needs to be a crisis, and then we address the crisis, but it seems to be that more and more international organizations are realizing that there needs to be a longer-term view as well.
Aren't genetically modified crops also part of the issue here? It's being pushed by Western organizations in some cases, and people are resisting, farmers are resisting? Or is that not a problem? Is that something that imagined?
I think it's not a problem as such, and in fact it could even be potentially a part of the solution. I think the whole debate around genetically modified organisms or GMOs is I think in many ways it's misinformed and misguided. We've been genetically modifying organisms for 10,000 years. I mean,
we haven't been putting fish genes into our corn until recently.
No, we haven't. That's true. We weren't smart enough to be able to do that. I mean, the type of plant breeding and animal breeding that was done in the past was really randomly playing around with genes and seeing what would pop out at the other end, and we would select what we liked. What we're talking about now with biotechnology, I mean, of late, is we have the ability to actually be much more precise in terms of what traits we want in our plants and our animals and our fish perhaps, and being able to actually place that into those products. And I totally agree that that there are a lot of issues that need to be discussed about in environmental and health and other reasons. But I mean, people are working on that, and so far nobody's really found anything significant out there. My point is, why would we take that option off the table? And that's the approach of the Europeans. It's not the approach in the United States. It's the approach of Europeans, and a lot of that is being pushed on other parts of the world, particularly Africa. We only have 3 countries out of 54 actually commercializing GMOs in Africa. And a lot of that is because of, pressures and a lot of confusion that's put in the minds of folks in those countries about, in essence, a balanced view about the potential role of biotechnology.
Well, let's bring a caller in who wants to address this issue. Kyle from Verona, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, my question was precisely about GMOs, because from some of my research I've done, it does seem as though they can produce higher yields with a lot less resources. However, the companies that often kind of use the technology most are, for lack of a better word, they're ethically ambiguous, like Monsanto, where they have flood markets with cheaper goods, and while ostensibly feeding the population at a lower price, can sometimes put farmers out of business, and which can lead to higher amounts of poverty. So how can we kind of use GMOs in a good way with but maybe get away from some of the worst practices of some of these corporations?
I think the way to do that is to make sure the public has a role in those kinds of investments. And so public investment in genetic improvement, including GMOs, really makes a lot of sense, and that we don't leave it totally in the hands of the private sector to develop everything. And that's very much the rationale behind the thinking of Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation and some others who've basically said, let's make sure that this biotechnology is not just suitable for large-scale farmers in America. Let's see how that can be applied to the needs of the poor. And there are some truly remarkable possibilities out there, and one of which is called golden rice, which is increasing the basically the beta-carotene content of rice to improve its ability to provide vitamin A. Now rice is consumed by half the planet, especially poor people. If we could do that, and we have actually shown how it can be done, when I say we, the scientific community, this could have an incredible positive impact on nutrition. 1 million kids either go blind or die because of vitamin A deficiency. So that's just one example of what I call pro-poor biotechnology. There are many other examples. They're developing new corn varieties in southern Africa that are drought tolerant. And with climate change, they're expecting more frequent droughts in the southern part of Africa. So if we target some of that science towards the needs of the poor and the needs of the hungry, then I think, that could open up, I would hope, a much more positive view by the public of the role of biotechnology.
Now, Matt, we were talking about drought, and Glenn just brought up climate change. There are people in this country who deny there is such a thing. But is that a reason? Is climate change a reason for some of the problems we're facing, or are these the normal cycles that Earth has gone through?
Well, we definitely, the preponderance of scientific evidence shows that indeed the planet is warming, and that humans and our greenhouse gas emissions, especially from burning fossil fuels, are throwing the Earth's climate system out of balance.
Have you told Rick Santorum that?
I don't think he would listen to me if I tried. No matter what the politician running for office may say, or a small number of scientists, most of the climate denying scientists who you see perhaps on Fox News are not actually climate scientists. The vast majority of climate scientists do ascribe to this climate change. What the science actually shows a human role in there.
So is the answer developing crops that can survive through drought?
That's definitely one of the things that will need to be done. We've already built in some warming into the system because of how long-lived carbon is in the atmosphere. What we've already emitted has sort of sends us to a little bit of warming, and when I say a little bit, it probably a degree or maybe two, and that's actually very significant in terms of average global temperature. So no matter what we can do on the reducing carbon emissions front, we need to prepare for the expected effects, which is includes more frequent, more intense droughts in some regions, more intense crop withering heat waves. Some parts of the world that are already very wet that get a lot of precipitation should expect more precipitation, which could wreak havoc on crops because of flooding. So the list goes on and on. We know that in general, crop ecologists tell us that for every 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature during the growing season above the optimum temperature for growing that crop, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. Just as a general rule, it'll vary from place to place around the world, but that's kind of the rule of thumb. So we know that the warming is built in. We know that in some parts of the world there's going to be more extensive drought, and so preparing for that by generating new varieties of crops that can handle it will be very important.
Today, as part of our series, within a series called Please Explain How to Save the World, we're talking about feeding the world. with J. Matthew Roney, a research associate at the Earth Policy Institute, and Dr. Glenn Denning, the director of the Center on Globalization and Sustainable Development at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And now we'll take a little break, and we'll come back with your calls and more of this discussion. We're back with our guests to today's version of Please Explain. Please Explain How to Save the World, a series that we have been running for the past month or so. And our guests are Dr. Glenn Denning of Columbia University and J. Matthew Roney of the Earth Policy Institute. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And James from Queens, you're on the air.
Yeah, this topic has been on my mind for many, many years. I'm from Jamaica, and I grew up on a farm, and I see how farmers work hard. But people provide for themselves collectively, and of course, there's a market. There'll be a market to buy produce. When you travel these Caribbean islands, third world countries, everything came from America. So you have countries, islands that can produce food, but the people are not working. And I always said urbanization destroys civilization because they move people away from rural areas to urban areas, and as a result, a lot of them don't know how things are grown, and they depend on ready products that are available.
It's more than just what's happening in the Caribbean. Even in this country, people are moving away from farms. In fact, aren't people moving away from farms everywhere in the world, Dr. Denning?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. This is a natural process called a structural transformation.
It's been happening since the Industrial Revolution began.
Well, it happened in the United States. 40% of people living in America in 1900 lived on farms.
But what about James's point that a lot of the produce that you see in Jamaica, country where there is plenty of farmland, comes from the United States?
Well, I mean that's a complicated story. Usually, it's coming from the United States because it is cheaper, and then the question would be: so why is it cheaper to buy fruits and vegetables from the U.S. versus growing it in Jamaica, which has a remarkable climate and rainfall that could actually produce these things? It's often because those countries, and I don't know Jamaica at all, but it's often because the investment has not been made, and the policy environment has not been sufficiently positive to support local production of those foods. And sometimes you have to protect your industry for a while, but it's absolutely necessary. It's very misguided when economies, like island economies, shift to urbanization, shift to tourism as their only source of income, and even worse, shift to oil and gas and the like. You have to protect those agricultural areas, and the beauty of it is you can, a place like Jamaica, you can grow just about anything. So I think it's all about government policy. It's about supporting investment, local investment, even foreign investment in agricultural production in those places.
Matt, do you have anything you want to add before I move on to the next call?
No, I think Dr. Denning did a great job there.
Okay, we go now to Jim from Morristown. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. I understood your answer earlier when someone said, should one buy agricultural products from poor countries because, are you taking food from their mouths? And you answered that probably they were produced by poor farmers in their country, and it's probably a benefit to them to buy their products. I was thinking of the case of the Irish famine, the potato famine, where there have been grain laws in force which govern the sale of grains, so that the local area or the country could not have grain shipped out of it while people needed it, or out of a district. But there was a free enterprise government which took power in Britain just about the time of the Irish potato famine, and they repealed all those laws so that the market could have its way. And so grain was being shipped out of Ireland during the famine, And many historians feel that that contributed to the famine. Now, is the case of the Irish potato famine not relevant to the present considerations? Are they related cases or unrelated cases? Are historians wrong?
Who wants to take that?
Okay. I'm waiting. Yeah. Well, you know, there are potentially some parallels there, but I think the point is this: if food security is an issue in your country, a decent government will not export food. And this is actually becoming quite an issue in Africa at the moment. A number of foreign investors and even governments from different parts of the world are trying to invest in land in Africa. And this will never be the answer to food security of the investing country, because I don't believe that those countries will export food at a time when that country is actually short of food. It's a national policy issue. It's a good governance issue. What I'm suggesting is countries like Jamaica, for example, would not actually be investing their, exporting their basic foods, their basic staples. They should be really targeting products that are highly valued in high-income countries like the United States. And I look at Haiti, for example, and I still cannot believe why Haiti doesn't position itself as essentially the market garden of the United States. I mean, it really should be doing that. You've got a lot of labor, you've got basic conditions for being able to grow pretty much everything a U.S. Supermarket would like. That's what's needed for development of that country. And then, if necessary, they can import some rice and import other products. But they need to be exporting high-value products that are valued by people like us sitting in New York City and shopping in the supermarkets here.
Now, Hannah from Manhattan asks, what about the importance of seasonal and local produce in terms of health and waste? In this country, we're seeing a locavore movement, at least among the affluent. Will that eventually lead to more farming in local areas like this?
Well, in the last USDA assessment of this, it's every 5 years, a new report comes out. They actually did show that the number of farms is increasing, and especially the number of small farms. So that seems to be a positive indication. There's also a growth in farmers' markets popping up since the mid-90s. I think they've doubled or tripled. So that can be seen as a positive movement as well.
We have a call from Tom from Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guests what their opinion is and what they think the future is of some of the more innovative market-based solutions to food security that have been tested out in Africa for the most part. I'm referring to two types, basically. One is drought risk insurance that has been purchased by countries like Malawi and Ethiopia. And the other one is an actual financial product that basically was a call option that was bought by the government of Malawi on physical maize. Their concern was that the maize price would go too high. So they basically entered into a call option, the option to buy at a specific price, sold to them by one of the banks in South Africa. I guess a general question, do you think there's a future for this sort of solution in places where food security is an issue?
And could that have much of an impact? You want to take that one, Matt?
Well, I'm not familiar with those market-based solutions. I do know that in Malawi, he mentioned that country, there's been a really high rise in yields just over the last several years. And to my understanding, that's largely due to the government providing fertilizer and improved seed to farmers for maize. And that seems to be a success story. I don't know if Dr. Denny wants to expand on that.
Yeah, I think that those ideas are great, and I think they're becoming increasingly practical. I think in the early days, they had a certain amount of interest value, but now I think we can make them practical. And one of the reasons is we're now being, you know, with new information technology and much better availability of data, and particularly weather data. The Earth Institute is doing a lot of work on climate forecasting and the like. And if you have that kind of information and database, you can actually produce these financial instruments that work. Now, added to this is now the new, basically the mobile phone technology generation. We're seeing right across Africa, virtually every household before too long will have a mobile phone. And that actually opens up all kinds of new, technologically advanced financial instruments and financial transfer mechanisms. And we're seeing it in places like Kenya and other parts of Africa right now. So I think, yes, there's a real revolution going on in that area, and it will only expand in the coming years.
Well, I found this statement on the U.S. State Department website. To feed the world's population, we will have to increase our food production by 70% by 2050. That sounds nearly impossible.
Well, I think it depends on, I think the assumption on the State Department site there may be that, you know, we add another 2 billion people from the 7 billion that we have now, and the question is whether we do that or accelerate birth rates, or if we choose to stabilize population at something closer to 8 billion or so. That will have a large impact on the amount of growth in food production that needs to go on. And the other part of that is how high on the food chain do we live? You know, there are many people, there are billions of people in the developing world that aspire, as their incomes grow, aspire to eat more grain-intensive livestock products. And in many cases, especially for the most poor, that's a good thing. More protein in the diet will be vastly beneficial. But for us living in the industrial world, we could probably do with a less meat-intensive, less dairy-intensive diet. That would lower pressures on farmers worldwide.
And a listener wonders about monocultures, whether that practice hurts food security.
Well, having depending on just a few strains, a few varieties of crops is probably not a wise way to go about feeding the world.
Well, you see that in the Midwest, where corn is everywhere, partly, I guess, because it's not even being thought of as a food crop, but rather as something that is going to produce some kind of ethanol product. But monocultures are the wave of the future, aren't they?
Well, I don't think monocultures are the issue. I think that's a little bit of a diversion. I agree with Matthew that you don't want to have all of your corn, all of your rice, and so on in just a few varieties. You need to diversify, and you need to have crop rotations, but you need to manage your land. I mean, let me come back to that point about 70% more food by 2050. I mean, the real crunch there is we've actually got to do it with more expensive energy. We've got to do it with less water because there's much more competition for water coming from, you know, urban development and other sources. And we've got to do it with less land because a lot of the land is actually being encroached upon. A lot of it's being degraded. So it, in a sense, it's even worse than that statistic of 70% more. It's just got to be done under these incredibly challenging conditions. And also you've got climate change, messing things up all across the planet. So it is a big ask, 70%. But, you know, from my point of view, it's actually possible. I think there's a lot of scope. And I don't think you're going to roll back the population to plateau at 8 billion. That's really not going to happen. Maybe 9 billion, maybe 9 to 10 billion. But I think we're stuck with this statistic. We're stuck with at least increasing to 9 to 10 billion by the end of the century. But there's a lot of knowledge out there. A lot of land can be, that's been degraded, can be brought back into production. I think there's still a lot of scope for increasing productivity on our existing land. I think we can't touch the Amazon. We can't touch the rainforest.
And we have to stop there, unfortunately.
And we have to stop there.
My great thanks to Dr. Glenn Denning, the director of the Center on Globalization and Sustainable Development at the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and J. Matthew Roney, a research associate at the Earth Policy Institute.
Thanks very much.